Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
We are airing this program about 1 month after the Christian holiday season of Easter, so to some the topic may seem a bit stale, but in my opinion, it is never too late to investigate the history of major events in our world religions. The event that takes center place on our table today is the Eucharist, and by that we are specifically referring to the historical event of the Last Supper of Jesus Christ. A book on this topic, which situates that event, and by extension all of Christianity, in the historical context of the time, recently came to my attention. And given that I'm very interested in historical topics and would like to feature more of them, I thought it'd make for a great topic of discussion. Given also that we just had two podcasts on the topic of Judaism, I thought this would also be a great transition back to some of our discussion on Christianity. The book I'm referring to is Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist, Unlocking the Secrets of the Last Supper, and is authored by Professor Brant Petrie. Dr. Petrie is a professor of sacred scripture at Notre Dame Seminary in New Orleans, Louisiana, and received his PhD from one of the other Notre Dames, the one with the football team in Indiana, where he specialized in New Testament studies and ancient Judaism. Professor Petrie is a renowned and popular speaker and has traveled extensively giving lectures on these topics and maintains a very spiffy website, www.brantpetrie.com, where you can see video and hear audio lectures of a number of the things that he has talked about. And you can also subscribe to his newsletter. We'll link to his website on our website, so be sure to check it out. And don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and check us out on Facebook as well. Hey, Brant, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, before we begin here today, I have to ask you a question about professional development here. And it's a tough one for me since you are relatively fresh out of graduate school. And by fresh, I mean you graduated with your PhD in 2004. Whereas I've been in this job for a couple of decades now. Now, when I initially contacted you via your website, I received an email back from your personal secretary. Now, keep this in mind. I'm working at a university where we were just asked to give up our telephones. We have to print out our own letterhead. And if our light bulbs burned out in our office, we have to wait until they all go out before we get any replacement. So how'd you secure this personal secretary?
Well, he's really more of a friend than a personal secretary.
Oh.
There are some guys who help me with the website at brantpetrie.com,
yeah,
who sell my Bible studies on CD. And being an absent-minded professor, it's in their best interest for them to field my emails rather than me to do it.
Oh, yeah, I'm having the same thing. So basically what you're saying is I need to get more friends.
That's probably a good idea.
Yeah, okay. Well, they can do that on Facebook, just as a reminder out there. Yeah, your website is also associated with something called Catholic Productions.
Catholic Productions is actually the company I was referring to. Michael and Brian run that company, and they help me distribute the various Bible studies on CD and DVD that I've been producing, as well as the new book, Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist.
Excellent. Well, it's a great website. I urge people to visit it, and it really shows your entrepreneurial nature here. And that's one of the things I love about the scholars we get on this program is their ability to really reach out to the general public and not just keep our scholarly ideas within the walls of the academy.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Yeah, because there are about 30 or 40 Bible studies on there, and we've found that it's amazing how many people will take up, MP3s or CD Bible studies that might not read a book. So it is an attempt to get religion out to the general public.
Yeah, it's great. I should also, recommend highly your book, Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist. And I generally recommend all the books that we have here on the podcast. That's one of the filtering devices that we have to get them on. I have to like the research that's going on. But this one is amazingly readable. And for me, I'm not a really great theologian. So it's a great blend between theology mixed with ancient history, or history around, well, actually ancient history. It goes back several thousand years or so before the crucifixion. So it's a really a wonderful read for most people. So if people are a little bit scared of theology, don't be. This is the book that you want to read.
Thanks.
And so I just want to remind our listeners here that this is not a podcast devoted to theology per se. Nonetheless, Brant, you're a trained theologian, but as I mentioned, you have really nice grounding in historical studies. And we're undoubtedly going to touch on some theological topics here, such as transubstantiation, which actually happens to be one of my favorite words to pronounce. It just sounds cool. I even use it in a political economy course I talk about.
Very nice.
And so I think our discussion today will really help a lot of non-Catholics understand what the nature of transubstantiation is and get the Catholic position on what it's all about. And again, it's not just from a theological perspective, although that features heavily in there, but it comes from a historical one as well. And basically, the theological controversy surrounding the concept of transubstantiation is really what kicked off your interest in this topic. So give us an idea of what transubstantiation is and how this influenced your desire to write the book.
Okay, yeah, no, that's a great question. The first point I would actually want to make that is that, just do a little brief work on Catholic theology for a second. The book is actually more about the real presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist than it is about transubstantiation. Those are two distinct doctrines from the Catholic perspective. So the doctrine of the real presence is on the Catholic position that after a priest says the words of consecration, this is my body, this is my blood, that the bread and wine are really transformed into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ, so that we can say that Jesus is really and truly and substantially present in the Eucharist. All that's left of the bread and wine are the appearances. But the Eucharist is the whole Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity. That's called the doctrine of the real presence. The doctrine of transubstantiation is a philosophical and dogmatic explanation of how that happens. So what this book is really focused on, and sometimes people use those interchangeably, but I just want to make that point. What this book is really focused on is trying to show the historical and biblical foundations for the doctrines of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and transubstantiation. It's trying to explain why early Christians would have ever come to the idea that the Eucharist was, in fact, the body and the blood, the soul and divinity of Jesus Christ, but using the avenue of history, ancient Jewish tradition, and close analysis of the biblical text. So that's the idea. And my own personal interest in that arose, obviously, as a Catholic. For a Catholic, the Eucharist, the Church teaches, is the source and summit of the Christian life. It really is the center and the kind of beating heart of the Catholic faith, because it's not just something, it's someone. It's Christ present among us. And so my own interest in this was piqued a few years ago when I was asked to do a presentation for some priests on a day of reflection on the Eucharist. And I remember I was asked this, and I had never done much theological study on the Eucharist. What I had done was a ton of research into ancient Judaism. So the professor who had invited me to give the retreat basically said, well, why don't you do something on the Jewish roots? Are there any Jewish connections, like the Passover or the manna, that might throw light on the mystery of Jesus' real presence in the Eucharist? So once I began to do my research, I put these two topics together, ancient Jewish tradition, which I was very well versed, and then the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, with which I was familiar, obviously, as a Catholic. But when I put them together, it was explosive. I found all kinds of connections and lights from ancient Jewish tradition and history that I had never seen before and that I had not seen others make in their books on the Eucharist. And I really felt like I had something to contribute, and I put together this book, Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist, as a kind of compendium of some of that. Some of the discoveries that I found in my research.
Yeah, and it is a great read that way, because as I was going through this, page after page, I discovered something new, and I said, wow, that is really neat. I hadn't known that. It also gave me the feeling, too, that I should have known it, that this stuff is pretty important, and it's out there, but, you know, that kind of slipped my mind on stuff, and so, well, you know, we'll start talking about some of that stuff here, and I want to also thank you for clarifying the difference between transubstantiation and the doctrine of the real presence for me. I should note that I don't think the word transubstantiation appears in your book at all.
In fact, it doesn't, because it really is focused on the real presence. It would take a whole other book to get into transubstantiation. And because that's a very philosophical explanation of how the change takes place. But I wanted to just focus on the presence of Christ, and that's really the main point at this point.
All right, so if I use that word transubstantiation again, you correct me. I just think it's so cool to pronounce.
Oh, no. Say it as much as you like.
Okay. Well, then we shall transubstantiate ourselves into the historical topic here.
Sounds great.
Okay, so let's rewind the tape some 2 millennia here and start talking about the historical context in which Jesus Christ walked the earth. I think most of our listeners know that Christianity is an outgrowth of Judaism and that Judaism was the religious reality of Palestine at the time of Jesus. Indeed, you can often identify Christians driving around by the bumper sticker that they have on their trucks that say, "My boss is a Jewish carpenter." What is important for Christians is that Jesus is seen as the Messiah who was predicted to come in the writings of the Old Testament. And this is pretty important for understanding the historical meaning of what goes on at the Last Supper here. So let me start by asking the question that you do in one of your first chapters is, what were the Jews waiting for at this time? Or in other words, what was the Jewish expectation about the Messiah?
Okay, great question. That really is the doorway into this whole topic. I think if you ask most Christians, or even most people who are somewhat familiar with Judaism and Christianity, if you ask them, what were the Jewish people in the first century waiting for at the time of Christ? The common answer that you'll find is this. Most people will say, well, the Jews in the first century A.D. were waiting for an earthly political Messiah to set them free from the Roman Empire. That's the kind of general consensus, that they were just simply waiting for a kind of revolutionary, a military figure who would come and deliver them from captivity of their Roman oppressors. But the fact of the matter is, although that's true of some Jews in the first century AD, like, for example, the Zealots, which were a military movement interested in getting Rome out of the land of Israel, it's not true of all Jews at the time of Jesus. And it's a very narrow picture of Jewish hopes and dreams for the future age of the Messiah in the first century AD. If you read, for example, the writings of the prophets in the Old Testament, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, or even if you read the writings of Jews from the time of Christ, like the Dead Sea Scrolls that were famously discovered back in the late 40s, one of the things you're going to find, and one of the things that I found in my research, was that over and over and over again, the most predominant expression of hope for the Messianic age was to describe the coming of the Messiah from a Jewish perspective in terms of a new Exodus. In other words, the Jews at the time of Christ, by and large, were waiting for God to perform this new Exodus that had been spoken of by the prophets, in which the Messiah would come and act like a new Moses and save the people of Israel in ways that were very similar to the way they had been delivered by Moses at the time of the Exodus from Egypt some 15 centuries earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the key. This hope for the new Exodus kind of paves the way for many of the things that Jesus does in the gospel. Just to give you one example, if you were a Jew in the first century A.D., and you had heard, or you were there, when Jesus feeds the multitudes with the bread in the desert, it's the only miracle recorded in all four gospels, you would have immediately recognized, hey, when's the last time a prophet came along who fed the people in the desert with miraculous bread? It would immediately call to mind Moses in the Old Testament. Exodus chapter 16, the famous miracle of the manna from heaven, which we'll get back to a little bit later. Those kinds of actions on Jesus' part, not to mention going down to the Jordan River to be baptized by John, which is where the Israelites had crossed over into the Promised Land at the time of Joshua, at the completion of the Exodus. Those kinds of actions by Jesus pointed forward to the fact that he was signaling to the people, I am not just the Messiah, I am the new Moses. And in fact, in John chapter 6, after the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, that's exactly what the people say. Once they see the miracle, they say, this is the prophet who is to come into the world. Mm-hmm. Now, any first century Jew would have known that the prophet, with the definite article, is a reference to the prophet like Moses, who was spoken of back in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy chapter 18. So they actually recognize it in the Gospels. We have evidence that people saw Jesus is this new Moses who's coming to inaugurate a new Exodus.
Mm-hmm. And the Exodus is really central to the Jewish religion. And it's also central to one of the most important holidays that they have, which is Passover. And so before we actually detail how the Passover was actually celebrated 2,000 years ago, give us a sense of what the Passover means and how it's connected to the Exodus.
Good question. Thankfully, this is one of those times where even if people haven't read the book of Exodus, they've probably seen the movie, right?
Right.
The Ten Commandments, you know, Charlton Heston and all that. That does a pretty good job of summarizing what the Passover was. The Passover at the time of the Exodus is a description of the final plague that's unleashed by God against Pharaoh in order to set the people free. And it is the night when God commands the people to take an unblemished male lamb, 1 year old, sacrifice the lamb, spread the blood on the doorpost and lintel of the homes of the Israelite people, and then to go into the homes so that, staying awake that night, there would be a vigil in which the destroying angel would, quote, literally pass over the homes of the Israelite people and then destroy the firstborn sons of all of the Egyptian people. So that's the origin of the expression Passover. It's a reference to that night of deliverance, which was the way, it was the mechanism by which Israel was ransomed or redeemed from bondage to Pharaoh, set free from slavery, and then began their journey toward the Promised Land. So it was a very, very important night. And it all revolved around this sacrifice of the Passover lamb, the spreading of the blood of the lamb on the doors of the home, and then also, very significantly, the command to eat the flesh of the lamb. That's where we begin to tie into the Last Supper at the time of Christ. At the time of the Exodus from Egypt, the eating of the flesh of the lamb was an essential part of the ritual. In other words, the ritual had a sacrificial element in the death of the lamb, but also a meal element in the eating of the flesh of the lamb. So if you say you happen to not like lamb, you didn't like mutton all that much, and you just killed the lamb, the implication would be that you went to sleep that night, you wake up in the morning, your firstborn son would be dead.
Oh.
Because you hadn't completed the sacrifice.
Yeah.
Now, it's no problem for me. I'm second born out of six boys. So, but it's bad news for my older brother.
Yeah.
I mean, that would have been an incomplete sacrifice. You had to eat the flesh of the lamb. That was part of in fact, it was the climax of the Passover liturgy.
Mm-hmm. And you make that very clear. And in reading this, you know, talking about the Last Supper and then reading it in conjunction with Exodus and making the historical connections, you really, you know, for me, it was one of those moments that, like, yeah, I should be knowing this. Oftentimes we read those in separation with one another. Now, that, what you were describing there was the Passover at the time of the Exodus.
Right, yeah, so about 1500 BC or so, depending on which scholar you follow in terms of dating. But yeah, over a millennium before Christ himself at the time of Moses.
And then this becomes a regular celebratory tradition within the Jewish faith. Give us an idea of what the Passover celebration looked like around the time of Jesus.
Okay, yeah, good question. Like all liturgies, you know, all forms of worship, there are changes and developments that take place with time. So by the time you get to Jesus' day in the first century A.D., there are both similarities and differences from that original Passover. You still have a lamb. You still have the pouring out of the blood of the lamb. You still have the feast on the flesh of the lamb that's eaten in the home at night. But there are several other elements that develop in Jewish tradition. The first and most important of these is that by the time you get to Jesus' day, you cannot keep the Passover just anywhere. You have to go to Jerusalem, make a pilgrimage to the city of Jerusalem, and offer your Passover lamb in the temple in Jerusalem. It has to be slaughtered by a priest, and the blood of the lamb poured out on the altar. And then, and only then, can you bring the lamb back to the home and then eat the flesh of the lamb. It's not like today, where sometimes people, if you celebrate a Passover Seder today, you go down to the local grocery or to a kosher store, and you get the unleavened bread and the sauce and things like that, and some wine, to celebrate the meal. At Jesus' day, those were all part of the meal, but there was an essential element that's missing today, and that is the actual sacrifice of the lamb in the temple. That was a requirement that you had to do. So, very significantly, we see in the Gospels, Mark chapter 14, Luke chapter 22, and other places, Jesus sends Peter and John into the city of Jerusalem on the afternoon before the Last Supper to, quote, prepare the Passover. And what that would have meant in the first century A.D. is Peter and John would have had to get a lamb. They would have to go into the temple. One of them would have to slit the throat of the lamb, and then a priest would stand there with a bowl, either made of silver or made of gold, and catch the blood of the lamb, and then literally the blood would be poured out on the altar of sacrifice in Jerusalem. And it's fascinating that Josephus, who was a first-century Jewish historian, our most important source for the period, he was actually a priest in the temple himself, he tells us that on Passover, at the time of Jesus, in one day, the Jews would bring and kill about 250,000 lambs.
Yeah, that's a lot of mutton.
That's a lot of mutton.
I mean, that
it's a lot of blood, too.
Yeah, absolutely. When I read that, I'm just, was absolutely astounded, To think about this in just the terms of the technology of the age and the time and the people migrating, it must have been really something to behold.
It must have been awe-inspiring. I mean, it must have been absolutely unforgettable event. I mean, most modern people, like myself, have never seen a single animal sacrifice, much less thousands and thousands of them in a single day. So this sacrifice of the Passover lamb was something that would have imprinted itself indelibly on the imagination and on the minds and in the experience of first-century Jews like Peter and James and John and Paul and Jesus himself and the Holy Family, Joseph and Mary. So this is an important part of that. And one of the things that's fascinating, another fascinating element about that sacrifice, which I discovered in working on the book, is the way in which the lambs were prepared.
Yeah.
So once you sacrifice the lamb in the temple, you, of course, had to get the lamb ready to be eaten back in the home. And this would entail skinning the lamb. So there were these hooks that were set up in the temple to skin the lamb, to flay it. And then, strikingly, as the Jewish scholar Joseph Tabry actually brought to my attention in an article he wrote, it actually would also entail spitting the lamb with wooden stakes so that you could roast it over an open fire. And what Joseph Tabry points out is that in the ancient Jewish writing known as the Mishnah, as well as in some of the early church fathers from the 2nd century A.D., they point out that the way the lambs were skewered in order to spit them to put them on the fire to be roasted and eaten was actually by taking one stave of wood and driving it down the spine of the lamb in the back, and then the other driving it through the forelegs. In other words, in the shape of a cross, they would have actually crucified the lambs, as Tabry points out in his article. It's striking when you think about the symbolism of that being linked up with Christ being referred to in the gospel as the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. So literally, those lambs would have all been crucified as they were brought back to the home. I mean, Jesus or Peter or John would have seen thousands of Jewish men coming out of the temple with their lambs spitted in the shape of a cross as they go back to their homes to eat the flesh of the lamb.
That was just such an astounding observation when I read that. It really hit me that I had never known that before. And I'm just kind of curious why we've never heard that before, or if we have we lost that from our historical
sense? Well, the reason we haven't heard it before is because in 70 A.D., the temple was destroyed. And so all of the experience of the sacrifice of the lamb in the temple ceased. And the only people who bring it to our attention are the ancient Jewish rabbis and the early church fathers who are writing in the early 2nd century A.D. when the memory of the crucifixion of the lamb is still alive and well. But after that, the Passover changed. Once the temple was destroyed, the Jewish Passover had to change because you no longer had a priesthood to offer the blood. You no longer had a temple in which to sacrifice the lamb. And so the center of attention shifted, even to this day in the Jewish Passover Seder, to the bread and the wine and not so much on the flesh of the lamb because you can't offer it anymore.
Right.
There isn't a temple and a priesthood to do so. So that's one of the reasons that element has been forgotten.
Yeah. Well, you talked about some of the similarities here between the Passover that was celebrated at the time and the Last Supper, and we'll be discussing some more in a minute here. But you also noted some key differences that became central defining tenets of Christianity. What are those differences, and how is that related to this issue of the doctrine of the real presence of...
Good. Okay, great. Yeah. Now, if we go out in order to answer that question, we have to go into the upper room.
Okay.
To follow Jesus and the apostles back to the upper room to celebrate the Passover and the Last Supper. That's recounted in Matthew 26, Luke 22, and Mark 14. If you go to the accounts of the Last Supper, you're going to see that there are many things that are in common with the Jewish Passover. You have unleavened bread. You have wine. Jesus talks about preparing the Passover. He takes the bread. He says a blessing. He breaks it. He gives it to them. All those things are standard in an ordinary Jewish Passover meal. But what's extraordinary and what's different about what Jesus does is that instead of taking the flesh of the lamb and making that the center of the meal, instead of interpreting its significance, which a Jew would have said, you know, this is the Passover lamb, which signifies or reminds us of our redemption from Egypt, he takes the bread and wine, and instead of talking about the lamb that was just slain, he says over the bread, this is my body. And then, significantly, over the wine, he says, this is my blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many and for the forgiveness of sins. Mm-hmm. So, now, if you're Peter or John at the Last Supper, you would immediately recognize that when Jesus talks about his own blood being poured out and identifies the bread with his own body, which was how they described the lamb, they called it the body of the lamb, you would recognize immediately that Jesus is reconfiguring the Passover meal around himself and his own imminent sacrifice on the cross. In other words, Jesus is revealing to the disciples that he is the fulfillment of the old covenant lamb, that he is the new lamb of God whose death will bring about the forgiveness of sins and whose blood will be poured out, not just on the cross, but in this new institution of this new Passover in the Eucharist. So this becomes critical for understanding why somebody like, say, St. Paul would have went from being a first-century Jewish rabbi who would have thought that drinking animal blood was taboo to being a Christian who writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, St. Paul says, don't you know that the cup blessing that we bless is a communion in the blood of Christ? Don't you know that the bread we break is a communion in the body of Christ? I mean, how did Paul get from A to Z in terms of his beliefs about Christ and the Eucharist and all that? It's because he would have recognized that if Jesus is the new Passover lamb, then not only does he have to die on the cross as a sacrifice for sin, but you have to eat his flesh as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in the Old Testament you had to eat the flesh of the lamb, so too with Christ as the new Passover lamb, he's giving his flesh to his disciples to eat under the appearance of bread.
Now, this really must have freaked out the disciples there at the time.
You can probably guess it did.
I mean, again, you know, they're situated in a context where, you know, I'm sure for a good portion of their life, they have practiced the Passover Seder at the time, and this is the way that they always did it. And
mm-hmm.
and now here we're getting this new configuration of what is going on. Not only that, but you have Jesus saying, you know, this is my body. How did the disciples react to that?
Well, we don't really get their reactions in the Last Supper account, but we do get their reactions in an earlier account, which is in John chapter 6, when Jesus says very similar things. In John chapter 6, we have an account of Jesus giving a homily or a sermon in the synagogue at Capernaum, where he also speaks about eating his flesh and drinking his blood. And in reaction to that, that's in John chapter 6, verse 52 and following, Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. So this passage in John chapter 6, Jesus identifies his flesh and blood as food and drink to be eaten by the disciples. And their reaction is very clear. It says many of his disciples left after they heard this teaching. And then the ones that were there said, this is a hard saying. Who can listen to it? So sometimes for us as Christians, because we heard about, you know, the Lord's Supper or the Eucharist so long, we tend to overlook and not feel the weight of the scandal of it. You know, what would it have meant to hear someone for the first time say those words? Well, they were scandalized by it, and many of them left them. And Jesus turns to Peter and says, do you too also wish to go away? And Peter responds, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. Which is essentially another way of saying, Lord, I don't comprehend what you've just said, but I know who you are, and I know that your word is truth. And so Peter accepts what Christ is saying by faith, and through faith comes to faith in the Eucharist, in his real presence in the Eucharist.
And you make a really good point that a lot of people do overlook that context. And I did too when I read this, and when you start talking about the reaction of the disciples, and, you know, again, a lot of them freaked out saying, whoa, this is not the way we do things here.
Right, sure.
But it becomes, that passage that you were just talking about there really becomes a central moment of faith. right? Mm-hmm. This is what Peter's, you know, has to make a big decision here. It's like, whoa, this is not the way things were done before. And, you know, man, like, as you said, I don't know what you're talking about, but, you know, this is my step in the faith, right? This is, I'm going to go with this, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really the only time in the Gospels that I can find where Jesus teaches something. The people leave him, and he doesn't attempt to clarify it. It's not like with the parables where he tries to, you know, explain or give the interpretation, you know, bring the apostles aside and say, don't you know that I was talking symbolically or anything like that. He just invites them to leave. He apparently is not going to budge on this teaching about eating his flesh and drinking his blood. This is a non-negotiable element of his teaching. And it's what we might call a bad PR moment for him because he loses a good number of his disciples as a result of it.
Yeah, no, that's it's absolutely fascinating. And again, reading this book really brings that to the fore and makes you rethink a lot of the stuff that you thought you've known. Anyways, let's continue on here. When we talk about supper, and we're talking about the Last Supper here, the issue of food is really going to be important here. And we've already discussed the role of the lamb, but you make a really important observation in your book, and I'm going to quote it directly. So you say, quote, when Jesus gave his most detailed teaching about what he was going to do at the Last Supper, he did not refer to the Passover lamb. Instead, he spoke of the manna of the Exodus, unquote. Let me actually continue on a little bit there, but I stopped that quote there short. Why was the lamb not discussed as much, and what is the importance of this manna or supernatural bread from heaven?
Oh, that is a great question. I've got a whole chapter, I think it's one of the longest ones in the book, on that issue. To make a long story very short, in John chapter 6, the chapter we were just speaking about, when Jesus wants to impress upon the disciples in his most realistic way the reality of his body and blood being present in the Eucharist, the image that he chooses to use is the manna. And I think there's a reason for that. I think that the reason is because to a first century Jewish audience, the manna would have conjured up another aspect of the Exodus from Egypt. And that was, in Exodus 16, this gift of miraculous bread from heaven. If you know the story of the Exodus, you'll know that in Exodus chapter 16, the people cry out to God. They begin to complain about being brought out into the desert. And so God says to them, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. And it says that they go out the next day, and in the morning, all around the ground, there was on the face of the ground, as it were, this fine flake-like thing called manna. And they named it manna because in Hebrew, manhu is the Hebrew word for, Hebrew expression for, what is it? What is it? What is this stuff? So manna, you know, what is this bread? Which is interesting because that question, we're still asking it to this day, right? What is this bread? What is it? That's what they asked about the manna. And Moses tells them in response, he says, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat from heaven. And so this is no ordinary bread. They only can collect it 6 days a week. On the seventh day, God would provide double so that they had the full sustenance that they needed for their journey in the desert. And the book of Exodus also tells us that the manna was white and it tasted like wafers made with honey. And why honey? What's the significance of that? Well, most commentators have recognized that it's because the manna is a foretaste of the land flowing with milk and honey,
right?
The land of Canaan, the promised land.
Yeah, where they were headed.
So what God is doing in Exodus 16 is he's giving the people a foretaste of the promised land. He's telling them effectively, I know that you're in the desert right now, but I will bring you to the promised land. And as a pledge of that promise, I will give you a foretaste of the promised land in this daily gift of bread from heaven. And sure enough, the people recognize in Exodus 16 that this is no ordinary bread. So some of it, they actually take it, they put it in a golden urn, and then they place it, of all places, in the tabernacle, which was their portable temple. Now, any Catholic, when you hear that, you think of our own custom. Catholics have a custom of taking the bread of the Eucharist after it has been consecrated, and we believe it's the body and blood of Christ. We will not only receive it in Holy Communion, but we will also reserve it in a golden urn called a ciborium and place it in a golden box called a tabernacle. So all of those Catholic customs flow directly out of this Jewish recognition for the manna as not being ordinary bread. In fact, in Psalm 78 in the Old Testament, it actually calls this manna, it calls it the bread of angels. They recognize this is heavenly food. It's not ordinary sustenance. So with that background in mind, if you fast forward back to John chapter 6, you'll see that Jesus actually uses the manna, this supernatural bread from heaven, as a template for what he's going to do with the Last Supper. In John 6, verse 48 and following, he says these words, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, and they died." See, he's alluding back. "So your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, and they died. This is the bread," he continues, "which comes down from heaven that a man may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which comes down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh." So essentially what Jesus is telling his Jewish audience, and this is at the synagogue. Can you imagine hearing this in the synagogue?
Yeah, yeah.
If anyone was sleeping at the beginning of the sermon, they weren't sleeping by the end. I can tell you that. What he's saying to them is, what I'm going to give you at the Last Supper, what I'm going to give you in the Eucharist, is not just a new Passover, it's also new manna from heaven. And that would have helped the early Jewish Christians, again, lay the foundations for their belief in the real presence. Because if the Old Testament manna was miraculous bread from heaven, if the Old Testament manna was the bread of angels, like the Psalms say, then can the New Testament manna just be a symbol? Can it just be ordinary bread and wine? No, not from a Jewish perspective, because that would make the Old Testament manna greater than the New Testament manna. And Old Testament prefigurations or foreshadowings, we call them types, they're never greater than their New Testament fulfillments. So like David is a type of Christ. He points forward to Christ. But David is not greater than Christ because we all know, remember that little incident with Bathsheba, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the way the relationship between the Old and New Testaments work. And so Jesus revealing in John 6, the Eucharist is not just food and drink. It's the new manna from heaven. In other words, he's giving the disciples the clue to understand the mystery of the real presence, to see that it is supernatural. It's a miracle, in other words.
Yeah, and that's interesting. It brings us up to this issue of the bread of presence. And you spend a great deal of time on this, and you mentioned this as another piece in the Eucharist puzzle that you're unpacking here for us. And you note that most modern folks, and I would have to include myself into that mix, really never heard of this. Yet it's critically important to understanding the Eucharist. So what is this bread of presence, and how does that term come about? Where is it in the Jewish tradition, and how did Jesus view that?
Very, very good question. Again, we go back to the book of Exodus. You can see how the Exodus is a template here. In Exodus chapter 25, we have a description of the building of that portable temple I just mentioned called the tabernacle. And one of the mysterious things that went inside it in the place called the Holy Place was this bread of the presence. It was 12 cakes of unleavened bread along with some flagons of wine that were put in the tabernacle as a sign of God's presence. It was offered every week on the Sabbath day by the priests, and it could only be eaten by the priests. And it was this very mysterious bread. Some Christians have heard of the showbread. That's an older translation of it.
Right.
But Protestants and Catholic scholars agree that the literal translation of the Hebrew, lechem hapanim, is bread of the presence. Or actually, some of the rabbis translated it bread of the face, the bread of the face of God. It was a sign to the people that God was with them while they were in the desert. He had not left them orphaned. He had not left them abandoned. He was with them. Now, that's the Bible. If you turn to Jewish tradition, by the time you get to the time of Jesus, we find something else fascinating about the bread of the presence. At Jesus' day, when you would go up to the temple, say at Passover, for one of the festivals, a custom was that the priest would actually go into the holy place, which the lay people could never go into, and they would bring out one of the holy objects, namely the golden table of the bread of the presence. And then they would take that bread of the presence, they would lift it up before the people, and they would say, "Behold God's love for you. Behold God's love for you." This was a powerful, powerful moment, because the bread of the presence was seen in Leviticus as a sign of, quote, the everlasting covenant between God and Israel, a sign of this sacred family bond between God and his people, a sign of his everlasting love for them. And that is going to lay the foundation for what Jesus does in the Eucharist. Because when he takes the unleavened bread at the Last Supper and says, "This is my body, do this in remembrance of me," He's signifying that through the Eucharist, he now is going to be present in the bread and wine of this new covenant that's made in his blood.
Yeah, and that, you know, that whole statement, when you just said that too, you know, when they bring out the table and say this is evidence of God's love, I mean, you get a shiver down your spine, because
yeah.
This is really what, you know, the resurrection is all about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
And so just seeing that continuity in the historical record or the biblical record here is just one of those things that, yeah, I should know this. Why don't I know this?
And it's just one of the things that we miss, because, see, it's not part of our experience. We don't have any experience of what the temple was like. None of us ever attended a temple service alongside Jesus and the apostles. So we're missing from some of the links between the Old and the New Testament that are provided to us by a close historical study of Scripture in its historical context. This is where history and theology really overlap in ways that can be very exciting and enriching for both fields. I would add this, however, as a Catholic, I do have one similar experience, though, to this, because in the Catholic Mass, if you've ever been to a Catholic liturgy of the Eucharist, you'll know that after the priest says, "This is my body and this is my blood of the new covenant," over the bread and wine, he also is required by the Catholic liturgy to lift up the host of bread so that all the people can see it. It's called the elevation. And that's exactly what the Jewish priest would do with the bread of the presence in the Old Testament. So when I first found that, I was blown away, because I thought, oh my gosh, I've seen that done before, but I've seen it done in the context of the Mass.
Yeah, and you would think, you know, I was raised Catholic, and you see the priest holding that up, and you're, oh, it's just something they do. You never really give it.
Yeah, you don't think about the roots of it, but those roots go back to ancient times.
You make a number of interesting parallels as well in your book there. You talk about the bread of the presence here. One is between the 12 loaves or 12 cakes of bread, as you mentioned, in the tabernacle, and that's linked to the 12 tribes of Israel. And how does that connect with the Last Supper here?
Oh, very good question, because at the Last Supper, as the Gospels make clear, Jesus is celebrating it with the 12 apostles, who are signs of the restoration of the covenant and of the people of Israel. Jesus actually says to them in Luke 22, at the Last Supper, "You will sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel in my kingdom. You will eat at my table and in my kingdom." So again, what Jesus is doing is reconfiguring the people of Israel around himself and his Eucharist. See, it used to be in the Old Testament, the way you belonged to the 12 tribes was through blood relations with one of the 12 patriarchs, you know, Jacob's sons. But now, in this new covenant, the way you belong to the new Israel is through blood relation with Christ in the Eucharist. By receiving the blood of Christ, you are constituting this new Israel, and that's why the 12 are there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those connections just really, again, very interesting. The next thing I want to move on to is not just the bread, but the wine. And
yeah,
a great chapter as well in talking about the Passover Seder. And you mentioned that the Seder, that term means order.
That's right.
And ordering in the language. So explain to us what is important about the ordering of the Passover Seder and how that plays an important role in the Last Supper.
Okay, good question. In a chapter, one of my favorite ones in the book, called The Fourth Cup and the Death of Jesus, I try to show that if you look at the Gospels carefully, in light of Jewish tradition, you'll note something interesting. Despite most artists' rendition of the Last Supper, there's actually more than one cup of wine mentioned at the Last Supper in the Gospels themselves. And this is exactly what one would expect if you know Jewish tradition, because in Jewish tradition, there was a requirement that you had to have at least four cups of wine at a Passover meal. And that's actually still part of Orthodox Jewish tradition to this day. And what we see in the Gospels is that the wine that Jesus identifies as his blood in Luke's Gospel is called the cup after supper, which in Jewish tradition would be the third cup, also known as the cup of blessing. We heard St. Paul refer to the Eucharist as the cup of blessing just a minute ago when I quoted 1 Corinthians chapter 10. So Jesus consecrates this third cup, but as the great Jewish historian David Dalby pointed out back in the 50s, if you look at the Gospels carefully, what is missing is any allusion to Jesus drinking the fourth cup, the final cup of the Passover liturgy.
Well, before we get there, if I could just back you up, because I think that's an interesting point, but I want to know what, in terms of being a Jew at that point in time, what is the ordering of those cups? What's the first cup? When does that happen? What's the sequence? If I was a Jew, how would I do the Seder?
The basic sequence is this. You would have the first cup, which would be the cup of consecration, where you basically, it's set apart to begin the meal, in addition to some introductory rites. Then a second cup would be poured, and that was called the cup of proclamation. And that cup was where the father of the meal, who was, you know, head over the family and leading the Seder, would proclaim the scriptures. So he would read a particular text from the book of Deuteronomy that told the story of Abraham and Exodus from Egypt, and he would expound that passage and proclaim it to the people, to, you know, to everyone, his family participating in the Passover with him or any guests that he had, in conjunction with drinking this cup of proclamation. And then after that second cup was poured, you would then have the meal proper, where you would eat the actual flesh of the lamb, you would have the unleavened bread and all brought up and brought out to be eaten. And then the third cup, which was called the cup of blessing, was the cup that was drunk after the supper proper, okay, as a kind of blessing of the bread and wine that had been given, and a blessing and thanksgiving to God for the redemption that had been won in the Exodus. And then after the third cup was drunk, you would sing some hymns that were known as the Hallel Psalms. It's actually Psalms 113 through 118. These were some celebratory psalms of praise and thanksgiving to God for deliverance from Egypt. And then once that hymn was sung, then you would sing the final, you would pour the final cup of wine, sometimes called the cup of consummation, where that wine, the fourth cup of wine would be drunk, and then the liturgy would be completed, okay? And that would be the end of the Passover, would be the final drinking of the fourth cup after the singing of the hymn. Does that give you a little better overview of it?
Yeah, it does, and it helps us to understand the sequence of what would be happening in the upper room that evening of going through all this stuff. And in turn, you also mentioned that there's some fasting that goes on before the meal. And
that's right. Yeah, before you did any of this, you actually had to fast during the day in order to prepare yourself physically to kind of generate in the body a physical desire for the food and drink of the feast, in order to get your spirit and your soul, you know, ordered toward the significant and the significance of the solemnity that you're about to participate in. Again, this is one of those things that resonates with me as a Catholic, because even to this day in the Catholic tradition, we have a tradition of fasting before receiving the Eucharist. You have to abstain from any food and drink for at the very least 1 hour before Mass, so that you can kind of prepare your heart and mind for the feast that's going to be celebrated. So that goes back to Jewish tradition, too. They had to fast all day, but then that night, it would be feasting. You would have lots of wine and lots of bread and sauce and lamb in order to celebrate the deliverance that had been won in the Exodus from Egypt.
Yeah, I like how you talk about fasting in that fashion. Oftentimes when we think about fasting, we think about it in terms of our own sacrifice, that we're giving up something. But, you know, as you mentioned here, it's also in preparation and anticipation really fulfill what's coming.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a real sense of almost vigil or anticipation of the joy that is to come. So that was very much a part of the Jewish practice and belief of readying yourself for something solemn and sacred like the Passover meal.
All right, let's get to this fourth cup now. And there's some degree of, I don't know to say controversy, I don't know if that's quite the right word I'm looking for, maybe ambiguity,
yeah,
about whether Jesus finishes the fourth cup of wine or not. Give us some background.
Yeah, that's right.
On that.
I think ambiguity is a good word. Like I said, David Dalby was a Jewish scholar who noted this back in the 50s. He said, you know, it seems there's an omission in the Gospels, because in the Gospel of Matthew and Mark, which mentions Jesus and his disciples singing the hymns. So again, that is a correspondence between the Last Supper and the Jewish Passover meal. After Jesus and his disciples sing the hymns, it says they just leave the upper room and they go out into the night. And David Dalby said, well, wait, any first century Jew and any modern Jew would know, well, you have to sing, after you sing the hymns, you have to drink the final cup of wine. But instead of drinking the cup of wine, we find in the very same Gospels, Jesus vowing not to drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And so there's a strange thing here. This is something peculiar. No Jew would have vowed not to drink wine in the middle of the Passover meal, toward the end of it, when he knew that fourth cup was coming. So Dalby said, you know, even though the Gospels are silent about it, we can infer from this that Jesus didn't drink the fourth cup of wine. And what I did in my book was try to strengthen that suggestion by going a little further down the road. Because if you go down the road with Christ in the Gospels into the Garden of Gethsemane, we find something else very strange. When he gets into the garden and he begins his agony, what is it that he prays about? He doesn't say, Father, deliver me from the cross. He doesn't say, Father, deliver me from being executed brutally and cruelly by the Romans. He doesn't even say, Father, deliver me from death. He says, Father, take this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will be done, but thine. And then a second time, Matthew 26, he says, Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, thy will be done, not mine. So he says that three times in the gospel. Three times he makes the same prayer. Now, that's a very strange way to describe a crucifixion, you got to admit. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were going to be crucified, would you describe it as drinking a cup?
Yeah.
It's odd. It's an odd thing. Whenever you see something like that in the Bible, you should kind of scratch your head and say, why did he zig when I would have zagged? Right? Why did he say X when I would have said Z? And one explanation that is ready at hand is that it's Passover night.
Yeah. It situates it in the historical context here, yeah.
Yeah, put it in the historical context. Why would he be praying about drinking a cup on Passover night? Well, it's because he's just identified himself as the lamb that is to be slain. And he's just identified his body and blood as the new Passover. So what's happening now is he's uniting the Passover liturgy that he celebrated in the upper room to his own suffering and death. So that once this new Passover is complete, he will be dead, just like the lamb would have been in a regular Passover. So, and I think the confirmation for this, we can find it if we keep following his footsteps on the road to Golgotha. Because on the way to the cross, wine appears yet again. They try to offer Jesus some wine on the way to the cross, and in the Gospel of Matthew it says, as soon as it touched his lips, he spit it out. He would not taste the wine. And we can guess why, because he had just vowed in the upper room in the chapter before, I'm not going to drink of the fruit of the vine again. But then when we get to the crucifixion itself, John's Gospel in chapter 19 gives us an important detail. It says that at the very end of his life, right before he gave up his spirit, Jesus said, his last words were, I thirst. So after all this time of vowing not to drink the wine, praying that the cup be taken from him, refusing to drink it on the way to the cross, all of a sudden he turns around on the cross and says, I thirst. Now, you better believe he'd been thirsty up to this point. I mean, with the brutal beating to which he was subjected by the Romans and the torture he underwent.
And you mentioned there was another tradition at the time, too, that when somebody was on their way to death, that you would give them wine.
Absolutely. Yeah, there was a Jewish custom of giving wine to the dying that we know about from ancient Jewish sources and Jewish tradition. Much like to this day, when capital punishment is practiced in our own country, you would give a man his last meal, right? Mm-hmm. There's a kind of custom of giving a man his last meal. Well, that was the same thing then, although what they would give them was a cup of wine, often to ease the pain, but also to give them one last taste of pleasure, as the book of Proverbs says, when they're in their agony. And so because of this custom, John's Gospel accurately tells us that there was a bowl of common wine there present at the foot of the crosses, which would have been given to the various thieves and criminals who were executed by the Romans. So when Jesus says, I thirst, he knows about this custom. He can expect to drink the wine when he's ready, and that's what he does. He requests it at the very last moment of his life. He requests that they give him some wine. One of the soldiers took a sponge on a branch of hyssop. He dips it into the wine, and he touches it to Jesus' mouth. And John says that when he drank the wine, when he tasted the wine, he said, it is finished. And he bowed his head, and he gave up his spirit.
Yeah, that's so amazing, just putting this together, because it really gives continuity to the whole story of the Last Supper, that the Last Supper doesn't just end when he goes into the Garden of Gethsemane. This is a continuation all the way to the end.
Absolutely. You said it very nicely. It's a continuation. What he's doing is uniting his passion, his love for humanity, his self-offering, his self-sacrifice on Calvary. He's uniting that sacrifice on Calvary to his self-offering in the upper room under the appearances of bread and wine. And he's uniting it all into one continuous sacrifice.
And you've as I mentioned before, this is really a wonderfully written book that lays this out clearly, not only blending the theology of the scripture but with the historical part. It just blends it all together really well. And there's still two more chapters in the book that we really haven't discussed. I'm going to leave that to some of our readers to pick up.
Good, and give them something to check out.
Yeah, exactly. We can't do everything here because then nobody
will get the book. No, we can't. In fact, I mean, even many of the things we talked about are just scratching the surface.
Oh, they absolutely are. It's an extremely rich book, even though it is a very fascinating read and a very easy read too. Not being a theologian, when I hear theology, I start to tremble. I say, "Oh, there's going to be a lot of big words that I don't understand here." But no, amazingly readable book and enjoyable. But you really has that intellectual historical depth to it that I think people were really going to like. But I just want to finish up here on the podcast and let you maybe talk about those last two chapters in general and your general reflections on this whole process of you as a scholar discovering this. What do you think that this really revealed to you in terms of your knowledge of the Gospels, but also your understanding of our contemporary celebration of Jesus Christ today?
Well, for me, it really, the research in this book brought home a number of things. First, it's incontrovertible that Jesus of Nazareth was not just the Messiah and the Lord of Christianity, but he was a Jew. And that if we really want to understand him in all the fullness of his humanity, for as a Catholic, I believe that he's both fully human and fully divine. If I want to understand that fullness of humanity, I really kind of need to dig in to the Old Testament and into ancient Jewish tradition to try to really honor and respect and understand to the best of my ability what those Jewish practices and Jewish beliefs were like that were part of the many centuries of the Old Testament era that paved the way for the coming of the gospel. Jesus would have celebrated the Jewish feast, Mary, Joseph, all the early apostles. This is part of my heritage as a Christian. That's the first thing, is that to recognize that what I belong to as a Christian is something that goes back into antiquity. This is not some new development or some complete novelty, although there are aspects of it, obviously, that are new. We've talked about that. But there is a continuity in salvation history, and I have a part in that. I'm playing a part in that. My role as a Catholic to this day who goes to worship and participates in the Eucharist is I'm tapping into something that's supernatural, that's ancient, and that is part of God's plan of salvation from the very beginning, from ancient times. And I think for us as Americans who often be unrooted, so to speak, right, we don't necessarily have a good sense of our connection with antiquity. Our country's a very young country. We often don't know, speaking for myself, much about our own biological genealogy. But this is a religious genealogy that tells us, what I'm doing here in the Eucharist, this is special. This is mysterious. This is unique. And that second word, mysterious, I think, is also another aspect of the book. When you look at the Eucharist through Jewish eyes, when you look at it as the new manna from heaven, the new Passover of the new Lamb, as this new bread of the presence, the sign of God's everlasting love for us, there's something mysterious there that tells me that I'm tapping into something more than merely earthly, more than what's visible, more than what's tangible or tastable, that I'm tapping into a true supernatural mystery of God's love for humanity, of God's redeeming act of sacrifice in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and that I'm able to move beyond the material world into heavenly realities that can only be signified by signs and shadows. In a certain sense, the Passover tells me that when I go to the Eucharist, it takes me back in time to the first Passover night, the night of the Last Supper, where Jesus institutes his new Passover and sets me free from sin. And then when I go to the Eucharist, when I receive the Eucharist, it also takes me forward to the resurrection of the dead with this new manna from heaven that's like a foretaste of the new promised land, the heavenly promised land, toward which Jesus is bringing me as part of this new people of God, this new Israel, on a new exodus to a heavenly promised land. And then finally, when I receive the Eucharist, that I'm really receiving the new bread of the presence. In the Eucharist, Christ is saying to me, I'm with you. I have not left you orphaned. I've not left you abandoned. I am here. But the way that I'm present with you now, after the resurrection and the ascension, is under the appearances of bread and wine. This makes me think, third, finally, of that last story of Jesus in the Gospels, on the road to Emmaus, where he takes the disciples aside on Easter Sunday. He walks with them, explains to them what happened, and it says their eyes were kept from recognizing him until he sat down at a table with them. He took the bread, he blessed the bread, he broke it, he gave it to them, and then it says, and their eyes were open, and they recognized him, and he vanished out of their sight. And I've always wondered, you know, why did he vanish out of their sight? And I think it's because, it's not because he's doing some kind of David Copperfield, you know, now you see me, now you don't. It's because he's saying to them, this is the way I'm going to be with you now. I'm not just going to be with you here in Galilee or in Emmaus. I'm going to be on every altar, in every tabernacle, in every church throughout the world, but under the appearance of bread and wine. And those of you who have the eyes of faith, your eyes will be open too, so that you can recognize me in the breaking of the bread, and that you can know that I'm with you always, even to the end of time.
Wow. I mean, that's you know, really powerful, and your work does just a tremendous job of really emphasizing that continuity and the you know, the wonderful mysteries of that we know of in the Eucharist. So I want to thank you for being our guest today on Research on Religion, and we wish you the best in the future.
Thank you so much for the privilege and pleasure of being with you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.